Get up now, get up now, get up out of bed. Wash your face, brush your teeth, comb your sleepy head. Hear your clothes, hear your shoes, hear the words I said. Get up now, get up and make your bed. Are you hot, are you cold, are you wearing that? Wear your books and your lunch and your homework at. Grab your coat and your scarf and your gloves and hat. Don't forget, you gotta feed the cat. Eat your breakfast, the experts tell us it's the most important meal of all. Take your vitamins so you will grow up one day to be big and tall. Don't forget, the orthodontist will be seeing you at 3 today. Don't forget, your piano lesson is this afternoon, so you must play. Don't shovel, chew slowly, but hurry, the bus is here. Be careful, come back here. Did you wash behind your ear plants?
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, December 12, 2011. My name is James Marino, and in the conversation this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Susan Egan. Peter is a writer who can be found at the Newark Star Ledger. He also writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, and as Kritzerland on Fridays, as we discussed last week. It's not Felicia Land, it's Kritzerland. Good evening, Peter. How are you?
Hi.
Also with us is Susan Egan. We love Susan. Susan, you have seen on Broadway in Beauty and the Beast. She was the original Belle, where she got a Tony and Drama Desk nomination. She was in Thoroughly Modern Millie, where she was Millie. She was the longest-running Sally Bowles in Cabaret. She was in Triumph of Love in the original cast and State Fair. Hi, Susan. So excited to have you with us this evening.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're really excited to talk with you, and it was trying to find a good excuse to talk with you, but now that you have a new CD out, we said, oh, we have to have Susan on the show, and let's talk about her CD. So it's with LML Music, and Susan, why don't you tell us, how did the CD come to fruition?
Oh, it's funny. I wrote a song about 2.5 years ago when my first daughter was 18 months old. The title of the song is Nina Doesn't Care. And it came out of the idea of I naively, James, thought back in the day when I was playing Belle, I would exit the stage door and there would be dozens of little girls excited to meet me. And I foolishly thought one day I'll be a mom and I'll have little girls and they'll think I'm pretty amazing. And nothing is a bigger ego check than parenthood. And so I wrote this song about the adjustment to parenthood that any parent goes through, but I look at it through the eyes of somebody who's used to being center stage and center of attention and egomaniac. And so I wrote this song. And what was so funny is that the song is so very specific to me and my life. And what I've learned is the more specific you are, the more universal the theme. And audience members would come up to me afterwards, after my concerts, and they wanted to know which of my albums had that song, Nina Doesn't Care. And after, you know, the 500th question of that, I thought it must be time to do a new album because, you know, I hadn't recorded it. And so much of my material has changed since becoming a mom. So the album fleshed out very quickly, actually. And the title track is The Secret of Happiness. And it's written by Paul Gordon. It's from his musical, Daddy Long Legs. And the whole thing is musically directed and produced by Georgia Stitt. And so I just got to work with a bunch of pals who I love and admire and respect. And the whole thing came together like a dream.
Paul Gordon and Georgia Stitt. So you're very tight to your Broadway roots there.
I am. Georgia and I are very tight anyway because we miss our Broadway and we're both here in California. And we knew each other professionally in New York, but we really bonded out here when in her 8th month of pregnancy, she called me up out of the blue one day and wanted to come over to my house so she could float in a pool. It was August. And I hadn't heard from her in 2 years. Then all of a sudden it's like, hi, Susan, it's Georgia Stitt. I'm like, oh, hey, Georgia. She's like, can I come over? I'm like, okay. And then that was the beginning of everything. And I was pregnant within 6 months of that. And then we were both pregnant at the same time, the second time around. So now between the two of us, we have 4 girls.
Wow.
And this last time when we were pregnant, we did concerts in all over the place called Susan and Georgia All Knocked Up. And we had so much fun doing it that we thought, surely this can play even if we're not 80 pounds heavier. And we just started building on that. And so we've worked a lot together and we write together and we have a mom blog together and we just laugh. We try and combine play dates with rehearsals and it's just a wreck. It's a total mess and we're having fun doing it, but we push each other along a lot. So yes, I do stay true. Of course, her husband's, JRB. So he did a couple tracks on the album too, and he laughs at our antics.
Well, Susan, I wanted to bring you back to Nina Doesn't Care for a second. You have a writing credit on that. Is this your first entry into writing your own works, or is this?
That's the first one that I've recorded. Yeah. So I had this idea for Nina Doesn't Care. It's kind of a cute story. So I was, you know, of course, Nina doesn't care at all. She tells me on a daily basis.
Nina's your daughter.
Nina's my yes. daughter, who is now 5, and she will still say to me on a daily basis, "Mommy, Ariel's still my favorite princess." And then I'll say, "It's okay, Nina. Truly, it's okay." And then she'll qualify it with, "And then Rapunzel, and then Tiana." I'm like, "It's okay, truly."
Yeah, you're in the top 10, I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm not. I'm actually not. She said recently. My second daughter's name is Isla, and she says, "You know, Mommy, maybe Isla will grow up and like Belle." And I'm like, "Seriously, Nina, like the ship has sailed. I'm cool with it. It's all good."
It's funny. Anyway. Audra McDonald says that for the longest time, her daughter would say, "Mommy, stop singing."
Yeah. Zoe did say that. And you know, Nina's first sentence was, "Mommy, no Lala." That was her first sentence. But, you know, I get
Yeah.
Well, yes, everybody is a critic, but they also associate it with time spent away from them, which I can understand. But anyway, I was at this audition for a huge sitcom, and I was going to be the mom. And long story short, I got down to the final. It was between me and one other woman, and I was testing in front of the network and everything. And to this point, everything had gone beautifully. I mean, it seemed like, oh, this is a natural fit. I live in LA now. I can be the mom. It's, you know, it's great. And it just, that final audition, it just didn't fly. And I knew in the moment that I uttered the last line that this was not my role. And I walked out and I got a text from my husband that said, "How'd it go? How'd it go?" And I just texted back, "I didn't get it." And I start packing up my stuff and I get another text from my husband and he says, "It's okay. You still get to be Nina's mom." Wow. And it put everything in perspective. And that, of course, is what the song is about.
Well, it's very it's a charming song. I love it. Everybody should take a listen to it. But you can easily by going over to youtube.com/Susan Egan, where you put together a video that, you know, on our podcast here, Peter and Michael and various other folks really talk about the art side of it. I talk about the business side of it, the business side of Broadway and entertainment. But that video had to have cost $1 billion. It was so good.
Oh, you're and sweet. I called in every favor I've ever had for people.
The video is really, really amazing. And it's up to 250,000 views or 250,000 views on YouTube, and which is outrageous. I mean, we have...
Let's explain what it is so that listeners will up that figure to 500,000 by the time we're all done.
That would be great.
Susan, tell us about what is very special about that video.
Okay, so the video is for that very song, Nina Doesn't Care, and we thought, how are we going to visualize it? It's a very visual song, by the way, but what are we going to do? And we started really thinking about, a producer friend of mine helped me produce it, Brian Hayner, who wrote the music and co-wrote the lyrics of Nina Doesn't Care. He shoots videos all the time, and so I got to sort of hop onto his machine that he had in place. But then I brought some friends to the table, and I think that's what you're talking about. And we thought, how are we going to talk about it? And we thought, what do people think a Disney princess's life as a mother would be? And of course, it would feature animated forest creatures in your kitchen. You know, I mean, if Julie Andrews as Mary Poppins can sing to a bluebird, and so can Snow White and Sleeping Beauty, then why not X Belle, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I called a friend of mine, Ken Duncan, who was the animator for my character of Meg in Hercules, 15 years ago, and he's got his own company now. And do you know that he is one of only two companies that still does 2D animation in Hollywood? And he loved the idea of the project. He loved the idea that it was, he does huge projects. So he works for Disney. He works for DreamWorks. He works for, you know, he hires himself out to everybody, and he, you know, Kung Fu Panda, like major credits. And, but he liked the idea of going back and doing old school, old look 2D animation like Mary Poppins, and the idea that it was going to be on YouTube. And that sort of guerrilla filmmaking and that edgy kind of thing. He wants to do projects like that himself. And so he came on board, and I mean, I have friends who are editors. I just called in every favor. So we put it together, and it turned out pretty nicely.
Well, because you have birds and what
chipmunks,
other animals?
Chipmunks and deers. But I did think, Peter, that my daughter Nina, who actually is pretty shy and doesn't want to do anything in front of anybody, but I thought that she would hate me later in life if she didn't appear in it. But she's, like I say, she's nearly five. So we found a way through the song to age the baby to five at the end of the song so that Nina could appear. But then I needed an 18-month-old. And Nina's blonde hair with dark eyes, and my 18-month-old has black hair and light blue eyes, so they look nothing alike. So I borrowed Georgia and Jason's baby.
That's funny.
And it's Susanna Brown who actually plays the role. So there
well,
you go.
Well, that's it. You know, it. I saw in the there's a making of the video.
Yes.
Video. In the making of the video that Nina actually didn't want to do some of the things because she thought she was going to get in trouble for the video.
That's actually Susanna. Nina, of course, did all those things from page one. She's the one I wrote the song about. No, Susanna is such a good girl. She didn't want to do all those bad things. She knew it was bad to color all of her cheeks in.
Interesting.
My daughter, however, had no idea what we were shooting. She kept asking, "Mommy, are we shooting the Little Mermaid movie today?" And I'm like, we all look at each other, the cameraman, myself, the producer, we're like, yes, we're shooting the Ariel movie today, yes.
Yeah, if you can lie about Santa Claus, you can lie about this, no question about that. So, and it's nice you gave your daughter equal time, your other daughter, because you have a song devoted to her, don't you?
Well, I'm just trying to avoid those therapy bills in the future.
There is no avoiding it.
So yes. Tell us about From the Stars, which is
your other book. So From the Stars is a little, it's definitely something I wrote a sonnet years and years ago about my niece when she was born. And it was that whole idea of she's a little cherub perched on a cloud somewhere and watching her parents meet and watching them fall in love and watching them get married. And so I wanted to capture that. But I also, people liked Nina Doesn't Care so much, but it's too specific to me. I mean, Christiane Noll can't sing it, and I want her to, you know. Mm-hmm. I want Rebecca Luker to sing it. I want Rachel York to sing it.
Sure.
So I wanted to write a song that really could be sung about anybody's child. But I want the sentiment is something you might say to them to answer the question, where did I come from? And that sort of lullaby, sweet, tall tale that you might tell your child. And the whole celestial thing comes into play. And of course, I'm spiritual, but I'm analytical. And, you know, I went to college on a math scholarship. I was raised by two scientists. Yeah. So I love the idea of us being stardust. And that's where we come from. And that's where we go to. But making that kind of a tall tale.
So, tell us how you ended up picking these 12 tracks. I mean, we've covered two of the 12 tracks, but I mean, from the beginning to the end, and then you finish up with Bridge Over Troubled Water, and it was so powerful. And what made you choose that?
It's all so personal. The very first track, The Me of the Moment, is a song that Georgia wrote for me. I wanted a new opening. I've been doing, since I left Broadway in 2004, I've been doing concerts everywhere because I can do that when I'm pregnant or not pregnant. Nobody cares what you look like. And I was just tired of my material, and I really wanted something that spoke to what's going on now. And she wrote that song, and she just nails it because we're both in the same spot in our lives. And so she gets that, who am I? Well, it changes in every given moment. Sometimes I'm a chauffeur. Sometimes I'm a diaper changer. Sometimes I'm a lyricist. Sometimes, you know, I'm a Broadway star. And sometimes I am decidedly not. So that's what that song is about. And it encompasses kind of everything. And then we go through the different facets of who we are. I used to think that in life, you travel from role to role in the way that you do as an actress. Okay, I'm Belle, then I'm Sally Bowles, then I'm... But you don't. I am still a daughter. I am still a sister. And now I'm also a wife and a mother. And I'm still a struggling actress. And I'm still a student. And I'm still... So you just keep adding roles to the plate. And it becomes a very complicated but very rich life. So I wanted each song to take a look at each facet. So, I mean, the very next song is a silly Christine Lavin song that was me in my 20s. And there's still that element of me of, you know, my mouth would get me into trouble. Whether I was working or in a relationship or whatever. I mean, who would want to date me? My God. And that song is about that. And then really when Georgia found the song, The Secret of Happiness, which is Paul Gordon's song, when she went to see a production of his play, and she brought it to me immediately, and Paul was like, absolutely, you can record it, even though the show hasn't yet been recorded. And I love the idea of it because I'm, you know, months away from being 42, and I'm a very different person than I was at 22 when I was cast as Belle. You know, I do pick my battles. I let things go, and I'm happier for it. And I think there's just a calmness as you're, ironically, as your life becomes more complicated, I think you learn how to skate through times and realize that, you know, good times and bad times, they're all part of the whole. And don't sweat the small stuff. Be grateful for what you have. You know, it was very interesting. The song, the whole album definitely resonates that when I was pregnant with my second baby, I found out I was pregnant on Monday, and I lost my mother to breast cancer on Thursday. And, you know, I am not a morbid person, and my mom was a 90-pound amazing woman who, you know, lived with stage 4 cancer for 9 years. I mean, she was incredible, and I was lucky to have her for as long as I did. But that's a tremendous loss, and that's where Bridge Over Troubled Water comes in. I mean, so we go through all these different things. We go through the motherhood songs, Mom Sense, which is just silliness, Nina Doesn't Care, Isla. You go through Finding Real Love, which is a song that Brian Hainer wrote called I Have You. Last year I did a benefit. Georgia and I sang a song at a benefit, and Jason Robert Brown, her husband, followed us in the benefit. And so Georgia and I were standing in the wings watching Jason sing this new song, and it was All Things in Time. And that song, it killed me. It was the first moment where I thought, I wish my mother were alive because she would understand this song. And also, Jason and I are the same age, and we grew up together in New York. Do you know, we came of age at the same time in New York, and he could not have written that song 5 years ago. He's a brilliant guy, but his outlook has changed too. Fatherhood has changed his outlook and being a husband. And, there's a grace and a simplicity to that song that I think he's a genius. I'm not alone in thinking that. And so that song kind of sums it up in a specific way. But then Bridge Over Troubled Water for me is my mom taking me to see Simon and Garfunkel when I'm a kid. And Bridge Over Troubled Water just has that essence to me where if All Things in Time is personal, Bridge Over Troubled Water is universal. It's the, you know, we can all heal each other. We can all fix what's going on. If you make a difference in your daily life, I mean, I know that's not necessarily specifically what the song is saying in Paul Simon's words, but it's what it's always meant to me of, you know, I'll take a bullet for you. I'll jump over. I will try and ease your pain with this by bridging the troubles that you're in. Because I'm in that space now. And if I can do that for you, and whether that's for my mom, and where she's at now, or whether it's for my child, I mean, it doesn't really make a difference, you know?
Well, the thing that was really prompted me to ask that is because it's not in the same genre as the rest of the songs on the album, of the origins, at least.
Right, you're right.
But yet, it was so connected with the rest of the work on the CD. And I knew that, I didn't ask you this before we started recording, but I knew that this had to have a special meaning to you because it resonated through the recording.
Oh, thank you. Yes, of course. I mean, Paul Simon is my favorite, and you know, I'm lucky because Paul Simon happens to be Jason's favorite too. So when Jason agreed to play for All Things in Time, I said, look, I want to do Bridge Over Troubled Water. He's like, I'll arrange it. I'm like, there you go. So that's great because he just, he loves him like I love him. but it is also the sounds of our childhoods. You know, I think we both grew up on Paul Simon music, and I think he's innately theatrical anyway, but you're right. I mean, it's even the track is produced outside the box from the rest of the tracks. Yeah. I mean, it has a lot of reverb. It has, you know, crazy organ sounds that Jason's mm-hmm. playing, and you know, but yeah, but the idea was to take the specifics of all the other songs and just now send you off as the listener with a universal theme.
One thing I have to say is that eight years ago, I was moderating a panel at Barnes & Noble that you were on, and I remember talking about the fact that so many actresses are so shy or reluctant to give their age, and you immediately said, I'm 34, and it appears you haven't lost that at all, because here you are, volunteering 42. I hope Jason's okay with it, because you just outed him as a
42 man. He's only 41, and I'm all 42 in February. But yeah, he's it's open on him too, so it doesn't matter.
yes, have to worry.
But you know, what's the point of hiding it? And I remember that panel, Peter, and what I was laughing at is like, I'm 34, and I think, and really what I was already thinking about in my head is, it's time for me to leave New York, and I'll come back in 15 years, and hopefully do the kind of thing that Alice Ripley did, where, you know, Alice and I both played ingenues to way too old of an age. You know, I mean, I was 34 playing Millie, who's what, 20, 21, maybe. It becomes ridiculous. Now, I mean, I was lucky that, you know, I got to start at, you know, 20 when I was cast in Bye Bye Birdie with Tommy Toon. So it's like, I was the right age for a long time. And then decidedly, I felt like I wasn't. And, you know, the Gershwin's a big theater and that's fine. But I also felt like, it's time to pass the torch. It's somebody else's turn. And also, I don't know how good I am at playing that new girl in the village anymore. So much more is going on in my life. I mean, even at that point, my boyfriend, who ultimately became my husband, was going through chemo. You know, he was in California. I was in New York trying to be, you know, charming and happy and Millie. And I, you know, and I loved doing Millie, but yeah, I'm proud of my age. I've got crow's feet. I've earned them.
Well, I almost saw your entire performance in Bye Bye Birdie, but I was at that Philadelphia performance. Do you remember this when the lights went out?
Oh my goodness! Yes, that's crazy that you were there. How far did you get into the show?
It was just when the guy was singing "Kids." And it was funny because I later talked to him. I met him some years later, and I brought this up to him. O'Doherty was his name. Do you remember this? Anyway, so I brought this up to him, and he says, you know, I will tell you what, when I was doing that and all the lights went out in the theater, I thought, I just died. I mean, he didn't think it was a power failure. He thought that he had died, and that he had some sort of attack, and that's what happened. So anyway, I was there in Philadelphia that day, so I almost saw you get through the whole show. But
Well, it all turned out okay in the end, and Rosie ended up with Albert, so it's all good.
Oh, I'm so glad you told me.
I know. It must have been killing you for these 22
years. I've been on pins and needles since all that time. So, and speaking of Broadway, so you do Cockeyed Optimist.
Yeah.
Is that because you genuinely are? Is that because you just like the song? Is this a statement about who you are?
Yes, I genuinely am. But also, it was one of my first jobs ever. I played the role twice at Sacramento Music Circus. Leland Ball, my whole career is because of Leland Ball. He recommended me to Paul at St. Louis Muni for a summer stock version of Bye Bye Birdie, Paul Blake. And that year, that summer stock version of Bye Bye Birdie, Tommy Toon decided to do. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to go back and change my major, because if this 9-time Tony Award winner is doing summer stock, something's wrong. But what he was doing actually, of course, was seeing if it was a good fit for him. And indeed it was. And he called me up in my dorm room the next year and asked me if I wanted to go on tour. He took three of us from that summer stock production. And that was because of Leland Ball. Then I get cast as Belle but I've got 6 months before rehearsals start. It was weird. And so Leland said, come out to California and let's do South Pacific. And Gary Beach was Billis, and I knew I was going to be working with him for the next job because he was Lumiere. Yeah. And that was my first time. And then 5 years later, I went back and I played the role again. I've done it at the Hollywood Bowl twice. So I've done the show a lot. And that first scene, I just think, is one of the most remarkable scenes in musical theater. Of course, it's a 25-minute scene of South Pacific. I love it. But I love Cockeyed Optimist. But what happened was I knew we wanted some kind of standard to anchor the CD a little bit as well. And Georgia had this outside-the-box arrangement of Cockeyed Optimist that just spoke to me because I know the song so well, but I am no longer that girl. I'm no longer Ensign Nellie Forbush. Mm-hmm. I feel differently about it now. It means something different for, you know, somebody my age to be singing it than somebody who is naive and hasn't done anything yet, who is green.
Sure.
And I loved her bongos. I love the bongo kind of funky, outside the box, not in the same meter version of Cockeyed Optimist. I just thought it was very cool. And I think makes you hear the words in a new way because we're so used to the regular version of it.
Well, given that you told us about your relationship with Georgia Stitt and you both having two daughters, now I understand more why she sang Children Will Listen on the album with you.
Yeah.
So that was your idea, I imagine, saying, Georgia, join me in this?
Yes. We do that in our live concert, actually. So we recorded it. And she, you know, of course, she's like, she doesn't even sing on her own album, which just came out this month, too.
I
make her do it. I make her do it. She throws me outside my comfort zone, and I throw her outside of hers a little bit. And in that way, we're both expanding what we're able to do. And now she's excited about doing that. And so she sings more and more in the concerts that we do together. And obviously she didn't write Children Will Listen, though she did arrange it. But hearing her sing her material, of course, is like nothing else because only a composer can really sing it. I think you haven't really heard a song. It's like listening to Marcy and Zena sing their material. It's just, you know, nobody does Taylor the Latte Boy better than Zena, honestly.
Absolutely. No, that's certainly true. It's such a joy. I mean, thinking as far back as Cole Porter singing Anything Goes and You're the Top, which we've heard on various recordings, it does make a difference. They know where the intentions are, and so it does make it a very special situation. So I agree with that.
So, Susan, tell us what you're doing these days. You have some concerts coming up and some other things happening.
I do. So now that my little one is turning two this week, I feel like I can cut the umbilical cord finally and go and work a little bit more. But the kind of work that I'm doing these days, I can't do 8 shows a week. I live in California now, so I'm not near Broadway. But also, I really don't want to miss bedtime when they're at these ages. So I travel 2 to 4 times a month doing concerts. Sometimes with symphonies and sometimes just with solo piano. So now I'm starting to book again, which means I'm booking for 2012-2013 season. Because unlike most work as an actor, you actually have a lot of advance notice when it comes to symphonies and concerts. So I kind of love that too. I love knowing that I'm going to work next year. But in the meantime, I've got a lot of concerts coming up that are just quick bookings. I'm doing a New Year's Eve show here in Orange County at the Rose Theater, which is a benefit for the Rose Theater, which is a really wonderful, beautiful theater space here in Orange County. And of course, in these economic times, arts organizations are having it tough. So we're making it a very affordable ticket and a lot of fun.
Good.
And I think it's like $25. And how can you go wrong? It'll be a lot of fun. And I still work and sing for Disney, so I've got some Disney cruises coming up. And you can go to SusanEgan.net. I'm constantly adding more dates. I've got some symphony dates coming up. I've got all kinds of things. Georgia and I are planning a trip to the UK. We're going to do some London concerts. I've got some concerts that aren't yet up on my appearances page, but in South Africa with Cape Town Symphony and Johannesburg. So, yeah, I know, kind of all over the place.
You also...
But you're making sure that you're not missing all of the terrible twos, right? I mean, you're going to be there for some of the terrible twos that your kids are going to give you.
So, okay, Isla, the little one, has been this dream baby. And literally, my husband and I, in the last 2 weeks, were like, oh, it's coming. It's coming. We can see it coming. All of a sudden, it's no. And the foot stomps down. You're like, when did you learn this? What happened?
My Charlotte has been in her terrible twos for 2 years now. So it's told her she's. I was sharing with Susan before we got on that my Charlotte is a felon. She's been stealing stealing money from mommy and daddy. And
it's a beautiful story.
We just caught her. So
are you going to prosecute? I mean, it sounds like you have a case.
I think we're going to put her on probation.
All right, that's good.
But you found so much money that you should just thank her for saving. You know. Nickel and diming you until it added up to that amount of money. Like
absolutely.
Now, your holiday is set.
You also, Susan, the Orange County High School of the Arts. You are an alumni, aren't you?
Yeah, I am an alumni, and in fact, in 2003, I just finished doing a sitcom for a couple of years, and I went in for 1 year to be the interim artistic director. So, yes, I'm from the first graduating class. And then I went in for a year 10 years ago and was the artistic director for a year with the understanding that I would only stay a year. And then I immediately went back the following September back into cabaret for like another 5 months. And then I did Millie for 4 or 5 months. But it's an amazing place where my very first solo concert I ever did when, you know, I wasn't, you know, playing a character in a scripted play with a fourth wall was a benefit concert for the Orange County High School of the Arts. And I did a couple numbers with their performing group there. And there was this young kid. So he's 10 years younger than me, if you want ages, Peter. Mm-hmm. And he was so adorable and super duper duper talented. He sang a song for Miss Saigon. And I just thought to myself, my God, he could be playing Chris like right now. But he was full of like, you know, his eyes were big as saucers. He's like, Miss Egan, Miss Egan. Or maybe he called me Susan. I don't know. But he said, how do I get there from here? Like, how do I get to Broadway? And I looked at this kid and I'm like, you want to know how to get to Broadway? You buy a plane ticket. And that's what he did. And his name is Matt Morrison. And
really?
Yeah. And 5 years after that, I was back on Broadway doing cabaret. And I was at Cosi to get my salad before the show. Uh-huh. And I'm standing in line behind Matt. And I'm like, Matt, it's Susan. So how did everything turn out? And he was like in his second year of Hairspray. And he's like, oh, my God, this is exhausting. I go, right?
Everything about it is appealing.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, so he's an alum from the school. So is Stephanie J. Block and Camilla Martin. Wow. And Krista Rodriguez and Lindsay Mendez. Like, it was a fantastic school. And so Matt and I are going to host this year. And Krista Rodriguez, too. She's going to be hosting with us. So that'll
hosting
be
hosting a fundraiser? Hosting?
Yeah. They, again, you know, it's a public school. California can't even pay for all the academics these days, let alone the arts. The arts are completely cut out. So they fundraise for everything. There's, I think, 1,800 kids who go to the school now. They have 11 conservatories. They have kids, you know, doing computer animation and editing on Avid systems. They've got a full orchestra that's played in Australia. I mean, it was an after-school program when I went to it, but now it is one of the finest arts high schools in the nation. But it takes a lot of money. And so we do the gala is a huge, huge fundraiser for them. So, yeah. And that's why they have Matt. he sells a lot of tickets.
He does.
I suppose he would. It's interesting how busy you've been over the years, but you did find time to make that wonderful Drat the Cat album. You're so terrific on that. And it's really hard to believe that that was simply a studio cast album because you really found the character. So it really is one of my favorites. And
thank you. That's Bruce Kimmel. You know, all him, his brainchild. Yeah. So brilliant. I'm loving his web series right now. It's hilarious. But yeah, and you know, we have always wanted, and we met with Ira Levin. We've always wanted to do a production of that, or at least in concert. And now I'm way too old, but I would still do it. if Jason Grah would do it too. Wasn't Jason Grah amazing?
Yes. Yeah, he's perfect casting for that role, no question. And so are you. So it's anybody out there who hasn't heard the Strathacat, it really is quite a wonderful score, and also has a very famous standard, thanks to Barbara Streisand.
That's right.
He touched me, though it's She Touched Me in the show, and Jason got the song and Susan didn't. But she has some other good ones, believe me when I tell you. So so it's a very nice album, and I'm glad you did it.
Well,
oh, thank you. I love
we have gone over and cut into Nina and Isla's bedtime time with their mommy. So
that's true.
So let me wrap up here by saying that you can see Susan at susanegan.net. She also has this wonderful mommy blog that she's referred to called Glamour and Goop with the wonderful Georgia Stitt. You can find Susan on Twitter at I am Susan Egan, and on Facebook at Official Susan Egan, and on YouTube at Susan Egan, which Susan and I go back a long, long time, back to the beginnings of the internet when somebody stole her domain name.
They did, and I still cannot get it. Yeah, so I'm susanegan.net. I can't get
it. That's susanegan.com, and we talked about that way back in the beginnings of the internet, and I'm like, oh, we got to be able to get this back for Susan somehow.
Dude. Yeah, there's this businessman who bought it. So that girl let go of it.
Yeah.
Her name is actually Susan Egan. You can't get mad at her.
Yeah.
But yeah, this businessman now owns it and wants like 10 grand for it. And I just like, there's no way. There's no way.
Yep, as they say, and a funny thing happened in the way of the forum, those filthy pirates. Yeah, so.
You're right.
Susan, there's a... Yeah, I'll talk to you later. There's a way to get that back. We'll figure that out. But Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
Indeed.
It's been wonderful to catch up and hear the stories and the videos. And you are just, you have made it happen on your terms, which is so awesome.
Oh, goodness. Well, thank you. You guys make me miss New York. It's such a pleasure talking with you. So thanks for having me on.
All right. Get to the kids and we'll see.
That's right.
Have a good one, guys.
We danced on your cloud as we walked down the aisle, and our lives filled with love as we traveled each mile, till the day we both stopped and knew with a smile what we'd missed. You, we dreamed of you, love.
All right, that was Susan Egan visiting with us from California. So, Peter, you've had a busy week. The holiday season doesn't slow down for you, does it now?
Not for a while. I mean, the last 2 weeks it will, but yeah, there's a lot going on. I have already seen 5 different Christmas carols this season, 1 musical, 1 one-man show, and 3 regular adaptations of it. So that alone keeps you very busy in the early part of December.
But you did get a chance to get out and see Bonnie and Clyde. Why don't you tell us about what you thought of it?
Well, I have to say before we start that I was reasonably friendly with Frank Wildhorn for a while. When Theater Week magazine was happening, I was put on the story of Jekyll and Hyde's getting to Broadway. So I saw it in Houston and in Baltimore and New Haven and so on. So I was on the road with it, and we became reasonably friendly. And I will tell you this, Frank Wildhorn never made a promise to me that he did not keep. Little things like, I'll send you that tomorrow in the mail. You know, people say that all the time and then they don't. He always did. Even all the way up to, when I get married to Linda Etter, you're going to be at the wedding. And he invited me, you know. So he never broke a promise to me. So we were reasonably friendly. The problem was that after every one of his shows, he would say to me, well, you know, and expect, you know, me to say, oh, that just blew me away, you know. I mean, and the thing was, whenever I saw one of his shows, all I could think of was that Charlie Brown cartoon where Charlie Brown is sitting on the stoop with Lucy. And he says, I wish I knew why people didn't like me. And she said, well, let me tell you, you know, let's get a piece of paper. I guess we're going to have to divide it into columns. I guess we're going to have to call this first page A. And poor Charlie Brown looks like, oh, my God, you know, this is going to be so painful. But, I mean, it was almost that way because I can't say that I responded to the shows that Frank did. And we used to have long conversations about it. But after Dracula, he stopped asking me what I thought because it was just too painful for him. And I understand that, you know, really. Everybody agrees that this is one of the better Frank Wildhorn shows. Now, again, that may not be saying much, but nevertheless, he does seem to be more in his element writing this music, which is folksy and kind of country and what have you. So the problem is, again, he often picks very odd subject matter, and this is very odd subject matter for a musical. And while I was watching it, I was thinking, okay, why does this show not work when Assassins does? Well, okay, you can say Stephen Sondheim wrote Assassins, John Wideman wrote Assassins, but you know there's more to it than that. And what it really comes down to is the fact that at least the Assassins in Assassins had lofty goals. They thought they were doing what's best for the country. They really wanted to improve things. Now, I'm not saying that they weren't insane. Yes, of course they were. Of course, two wrongs don't make a right, and this is not the way to solve any problems. But at least in their minds, they were doing something good. And we also get the impression, I can't say we can say this for sure, but we get the impression that the people in Assassins, if they killed once, that would be the end of it. They wouldn't go on a rampage. They would kill the person who they really believe is ruining the country. Well, with Bonnie and Clyde, you're dealing with two people who make it quite clear from the outset they are looking for fame and fortune. They are out for themselves, not for the good of anybody else but themselves. So that is a big problem. We cannot get behind them for that reason. So you might say, well, wait a minute, excuse me, but I mean, this was a very popular movie in the 60s. And one could say, well, you know, that was around a time when people were pretty discontent. On the other hand, people are pretty discontent now. So that doesn't answer that question. I think the difference is in 1967 when the movie came out, and I was invited to a screening of the movie back then, believe me, and I will never forget the extermination scene. And that's what I mean. They didn't just kill them. They exterminated them. The thing was, though, that they were new to us. I mean, it was fascinating because it was new to us. We had never really heard of Bonnie and Clyde. But now everybody knows who they are, so we have these preconceived notions of who they are, and we really can't get behind them in a musical. It's just not a very good idea to have done this as a musical to begin with. And I have to say that some of the choices that have made have been really strange on the lyricist's part. I'm talking even about specific lyrics like, I want to be like Chicago's Al Capone. Chicago's Al Capone, as opposed to Schenectady's Al Capone,
yeah.
As opposed to Lansing, Michigan's Al Capone. You know, you can tell they're padding a line. But there is a lyric, actually, when he actually sings, all I've done was rob a few stores. You know, and the point is, if this guy really rationalizes that he's doing nothing wrong, I mean, we have to be appalled at the fact that this is the way he looks at things. Now, they tried to ameliorate this by starting out by the fact that he was raped in prison. And I'm sure that's no fun. Don't misunderstand me. But again, two wrongs don't make a right. And we cannot condone a guy going out and killing people because he was raped in prison. He really does seem, it's really set up very strongly at the beginning when he talks, he sort of sees it as a cowboy movie. There are cowboy movies, literally cowboy movies played on the back wall while he is singing his opening song. So he sort of views this in those terms, and we really get the impression, once again, that art is powerful, and if you see things like that on the screen, you want to emulate that stuff. So that's why we really have to be careful what we show our kids. Similarly speaking, Bonnie wants to be the it girl. She wants to be the next Clara Bow. She wants fame as well. So the point is, here are these people who want fame and they will take it at any cost. They confuse fame with notoriety. And it really is a tremendous problem for an audience to watch these people just be out for themselves. Ironically enough, the character we're most interested in is Clyde's sister-in-law, which was a role that Estelle Parsons won an Oscar for in the movie. But I think it's even more better developed. I haven't seen the picture since its initial run. I mean, I have vivid memories of some of it, but not all of it. The thing I remember most about Estelle Parsons, I think is what everybody remembers, that she was in a scene where she screamed a great deal. That doesn't happen in the musical. But here's a woman who's trying to get her husband, who is Clyde's brother, on the straight and narrow. And she becomes a very interesting character. Also, Bonnie's mother is very interesting as well. And again, she wants her daughter to go on the straight and narrow, of course, as you would expect. There's also a love interest, or would-be love interest, because Bonnie has a cop who's very interested in her, and he just isn't exciting to her. But she does want this exciting life. And again, we are forced to ask the question, why is it that so many women are attracted to bad boys? It would be fascinating if this show could answer that question. It doesn't seem that it can. I don't know. I saw opportunities for songs that were missed. There's one moment when Clyde's in jail. Bonnie isn't. And she goes to kiss him. And she has to stick her head somewhat between the bars as much as she can, and he must do that too. What's it like to kiss somebody when there are steel bars on each side of your head? To me, that seems like an interesting song. What can I tell you? It may not to you, but again, the songs seem to be more interested in being pop songs than being songs that really deal with the situations and the characters. That's wrong. I did think we were going to get through this without one famous Frank Wildhorn device, which is he does these power ballads, and they keep on accelerating, and boom, then they stop, and then the piano tinkles in the background, you know, and it goes off to a soft little finish. I don't like that type of thing at all. I've told him that, too. I mean, to me, that's coitus interruptus. We're building to a climax, and then he stops it. So it's a strange type of musical teasing that I don't much like. So I will say this. It's very interesting to me. I haven't seen Clear Day yet, but Bonnie and Clyde did not get the worst reviews of the season. You know, Clear Day's reviews were far worse than Bonnie and Clyde. And even though it looks like Bonnie and Clyde will call it a life at the end of December, the fact is they can at least hold their head up high that they weren't the most panned show of the 2011-2012 season. So that has to be some consolation. But I guess we're going to see Jeremy Jordan in Newsies. I guess we are. It's ironic this show takes place in 1934, which is the exact same year of Anything Goes, and Laura Osnes was in that, the Sutton Foster production, so she traded one 1934 musical. And I guess that didn't turn out to be such a wise choice. So, but it's hard to be smart, and I understand the intoxication of playing the lead role in a famous role is one that's hard to turn down. So so she did take a chance. The interesting thing, of course, always is with Frank Wildhorn, is that this is now the third time that people are saying it's all over for him now. That's it. We'll never hear from him again. We first heard that after Dracula. He's finished. You know, and yet he got Wonderland. Who would think that this guy would have two musicals in 1 year on Broadway? Okay, both failed, both lasted a very short period of time, but somehow this guy can still get them on. I really admire his confidence. When he sits down at the piano to play Backers of Song, I've seen him do it. You know, it's like, wait till you hear the song, you're not going to believe how good it is. And it really is an object lesson how confidence really goes a long way and how it helps a lot of us. And many of us should really get much more of it because we will be far more successful if we can adopt this. So so that's Bonnie and Clyde, which I have not heard one human being say anything different, that it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be, or it's not that bad. And that's basically the consensus. So, but of course, you can't run very long with those reviews.
Well, you know, the theater. In relation to the movie, I'd seen the movie years ago, so I really can't remember much about it other than it being, it felt like a big star vehicle with Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway and Gene Wilder and everybody else that was in it. I don't know. You know, if they hadn't had the great star turns and the studios having such, in 1967, having such great control over what would become a hit or not, and deciding on what, you know. I wonder if Bonnie and Clyde were just another movie made today with a handful of people who were not superstars, if it would have been the runaway movie that it was. And
well, to be fair, Warren Beatty, yes, was famous at that time, but Faye Dunaway wasn't. Ironically enough, that same year that Bonnie and Clyde was coming out, which came out in the fall of 67, I was working at a hotel in Boston where they were filming the Thomas Crown Affair, which is indeed was her next picture, that came out in the summer of 68. Mm-hmm. And I will say this, that even though she was not yet a star, She certainly acted like one in the hotel. But do you know that in Dayton, Ohio, when she came there to do master class, she was so difficult that at the end of the run, the manager of the theater actually went out and at his expense printed up T-shirts that said, "We've done away with Faye." But she really wasn't, and nobody knew who she was before Bonnie and Clyde. And similarly, Gene Wilder, too, because the producers came out the following year. Mm-hmm. So they weren't famous people. And yeah, some of us in the theater knew Estelle Parsons for various roles here and there. But actually, it was only Warren Beatty who was famous, and he was at that time really more famous for being Shirley MacLaine's brother than being a big movie star. He had a few good roles here and there, but he wasn't a superstar. That's the picture that made him a superstar.
Okay.
These anti-hero shows, they're the trickiest of all. They're the toughest of all. And, that's why going back to Pal Joey, which took its lumps. It did run a good long time when it was first produced, more than people think it did. But still, considering the worth of what that show was and how forward-looking it was, it deserved a longer run than the 300-odd performances it ran back then. So the anti-hero musical is a tough thing to do. And, you might say, well, Sweeney Todd. Yeah, but, again, Sweeney Todd is about a guy who really wants revenge on one person. One person. And then, when he just misses getting him, that's when he goes crazy. And they establish that he is crazy. Okay, here, it's never established that Bonnie and Clyde are crazy. You can infer that. You're more than welcome to infer that, and you may very well infer that. But they do not see themselves that way. Again, all I did was rob a few stores. There's a lot of that going on in this show. And thrilled when they're on the front page of the paper as if they really had done something truly wonderful for mankind. That's the way they react. And that's supposed to be funny. And I think the humor in that has paled since we had seen it originally. There was something I remember so vividly when I saw that picture. The first time that they killed somebody, I laughed for a second because the Charles Strauss music was playing in the background and it looked like it was fun. And the second after I reacted like, oh, isn't that cool? Wait a minute. This isn't cool. They just killed somebody. This is horrible. Well, it's even harder now and harder in a musical to make that palatable. So I think it was a bad idea from the beginning.
Yeah. All right. You also saw A Man Who Came to Dinner. So why don't you give us a rundown on that?
The Man Who Came to Dinner, of course, it's so wonderful that a classic play with a million people in the cast gets done, because that's usually the real problem of doing a show like this. All these plays from way back when require so many people that most managements are reluctant to do it. But the Peccadillo Theater Company and Dan Wackerman said, no, we're doing it. And it really is quite a nice thing that they were able to do it, and do it, I think, quite nicely. Now, frankly, I welcome the fact to see it done in a different way. And I dare say it was done in a different way, because usually it's very farcical. And a lot of people are going to take issue with this, but I enjoyed Jim Brochu amazingly downplaying it and becoming a real human being from the get-go. A lot of people say, wait, this guy's just not a human being. Well, yes, he is. He may be a holy terror, but he is a human being. And that really comes through in Jim's performance. So I think he really did a very fine job there. I liked him quite a bit in the role. I also liked Katie Huffman quite a bit. She was really quite sensational playing Lorraine Sheldon, the woman that he calls in so that he can keep his secretary, Maggie Cutler. That's really important to him, to keep Maggie, that's played by Amy Landon, who I really thought was excellent as Maggie, who really had both the backbone that one is needed to stand up to Sheridan Whiteside. And there's a point where she says, "Now you listen, Whiteside," and she delivered that speech very, very nicely. And what fun to see Joe Sicari again, a veteran actor who was in the original cast of Dames at Sea in 1968. Here he is playing Banjo Reed Harpo. That's part of the fun of the show, that you get to see people who were famous at the time, just slightly disguised, and that's a lot of fun to see him play the Harpo Marx role, who turns out to be extraordinarily important to the plot in the very last scene. And so he's quite nice. And I had a very nice time at this show. Beautifully produced. Lovely set. Lovely set indeed. Let me also give a nod to Christine Nivens playing Miss Preen, the nurse who has to go crazy dealing with Sheridan Whiteside. So it's only running till the end of this week, and that'll be that. I'm sorry that it has such a short run, because I really think it deserves much more than that. So but we're lucky we have it. You know, as I say, you just don't get these big cast comedies the way we used to. So so thank you, Peccadillo. Thank you, Dan Wackerman. And thanks to the cast for doing it so nicely.
Yeah, I was looking here that the last revival on Broadway was in 2000.
That was the famous Nathan Lane one that was cast on TV. Yeah, and that's where many of us discovered Harriet Harris, who was Maggie in that production, and that was the first time I recall seeing her, and she really made a very good impression on me too. And you know, Harriet Harris is somebody who, you know, I just enjoy more and more and more and more as time goes on. If you haven't seen her in this Standing on Ceremony, which is closing shortly too, I really urge you to get down to the Bonetta Lane, because she is truly hilarious and giving what I really believe is the best performance I've seen an actress give in a supporting comedic role this year, this season. So I highly recommend her, and I know she has a lot of fans. I also saw her this year at the George Street Playhouse in a musical called It Should Have Been You, and she was wonderful in that too. But actually, I think she's even better in Standing on Ceremony at the Menanda Lane, so I would recommend her highly for this. But yeah, Nathan Lane, Harriet Harris, and Jean Smart playing Lorraine Sheldon. I enjoyed that production, and it did show up on PBS, and I imagine that a lot of us had our TiVos or even videotape taking it down at that time. So even though it was not released commercially, I bet you can find somebody who has it.
Yeah. Next up, you saw Wild Animals, and we had talked about it a few weeks back, but I don't think that you were on. I think you were at CCM when.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah, I thought this play was terrific, and it sadly enough is a play for our times, because it is about child molestation, but it certainly takes a different slant. And this is the fact that what we really have here is a young handsome boy who enjoys being adored, and he comes on to people purposely just to get the gratification of, hey, I've got to see how much people want me. And he comes on to his scoutmaster, and that's a fascinating scene when he does it. Everything that happens in this play may seem inevitable to a lot of people. I've heard that criticism levied against this play, and I understand that. But I look at this in a different way. I see that everything that happens in this play happens logically, and it's so true to character that it has to play out the way it does. But I found it a riveting 90 minutes, and I thought it was beautifully acted. So Manhattan Class Company, which really almost always does spectacular work down at the Lucille Lortel Theater, certainly didn't let me down here. And the relationship between the young man, the young narcissistic lad, and his best friend, who of course is not anything like him at all, as so many wonderfully Greek god Apollo type guys or beautiful, beautiful girls. They often have as best friend people who are so far beneath them in looks because it only accentuates how much more spectacular they are. That's a very common thing. I've seen it a lot in high schools. And of course, the less attractive person is so thrilled that this exalted favored person is giving them the time of day that it means everything to them. Which I want to do a side story here very quickly about the time when I went to a student matinee of the Cape Man. At the end of the show, Mark Antony talked to the kids afterwards. And, you know, there are all these pretty girls who are batting their eyelashes at Mark Antony, you know, and trying to get him to pay attention to them. And at the end, he went up to a very heavy-set girl and kissed her on the cheek, and suddenly she was the star. And it was amazing to watch those other girls saying, does this girl have something we don't know about? Wow, maybe we should really give her a chance. Maybe we should pay more attention to this girl. And what he did for that girl that day, I will always remember and thank him for forever, because I thought that was a really nice thing to do. But anyway, yes, the boy in Wild Animals who thinks he's the be-all and end-all does have a nerdy type of friend. What's also interesting about the play to me is that you meet the parents of the Greek god boy, and they have no idea what their kid is like. And I think that's true of so many parents, that they really have no idea what their kids are like. Going back to my parents, who had no idea what I was doing, believe me. And so I think that's very true to life, that people have idealized views of their kids. And if there's no trouble brewing, they leave it alone and they assume everything's all right, where trouble could really be right around the corner or even be happening right now. So I found it a fascinating play, and it was one of the strongest scripts of the season as far as I was concerned.
So Wild Animals is down at the Lortel, but it is produced by Manhattan Class Company. Mm-hmm. And they also have Carrie coming up. That's starting to be everybody's talking about with Maren Maisie.
You know what I hope what happens with this production?
With Wild Animals or Carrie?
Carrie.
Yeah.
What I hope happens is that Ken Mandelbaum will be interviewed a great deal about this. Ken, of course, wrote the classic book, Not Since Carrie, about Broadway flops. And he sort of walked away from the scene. And I'm hoping that people will be smart enough to say, hey, now that it's coming back, you know, we have a new production. Is it different? Is it wildly different? What changes did they make? Were they for the good, for the bad? But I'm hoping this is something that reintroduces Ken Mandelbaum, that it'll spur him into joining the fray again, because we've missed him much too long a time that he hasn't been writing. And I'd like to see him do a new book, which on Broadway flops, which would have to be called Since Carrie. So I'm rooting for that. But yeah, we're all curious about this Carrie. I'm telling you, you know, frankly, I saw it way back when, and I have to say I was on their side from the first second. I mean that because what they had done, they had painted the walls of the Virginia Theater, it was called at that time, it's now the August Wilson, black, totally black. And what they did not dim the house lights. They just snapped them off like a light you have in the kitchen, and suddenly you were in pitch black darkness. You couldn't see anything. It was incredible. What a way to set a mood. You know, and I thought, you know, I've seen thousands of shows and nobody's ever thought of doing this. So I was on their side right away. And I went to a preview, and I have to say, I thought Carrie was a hit. I didn't think it was a masterpiece, but I thought they were going to make it, because that audience went crazy for it. And so I think Carrie certainly has a chance. And I don't know what they've done to it. I don't know if they've done a lot, a little. We'll have to wait and see. But nevertheless, it certainly is one of the more intriguing projects of this season, or for that matter, any other.
It would be great to see Ken back in the in the theater fold.
It's been so smart.
Way too long.
Oh yeah.
It was like when the last of the theater magazines packed it in theater magazine. It seemed like Ken had just wrapped it up and closed his tent and left town.
He was working for Broadway.com for
a while.
Oh,
that's true. That's right.
But But I don't know the story. I don't know what happened, but suddenly he was gone, and it was much too quick an exit, and we all mourn it because, I'll never forget when his book on Chorus Line and Michael Bennett came out, I made the big mistake of buying it around 11 o'clock at night, and I went home, and I was up at 5 in the morning. So I wasn't going to make that mistake with Not Since Carrie. When that came out, I bought it early in the morning, and I was still up till 5 o'clock in the morning because it was so fascinating. So those are two great books, and I would like to see him do more. So maybe Carrie will be enough to seduce him into coming back to the fold.
That's a great thought. So you also got down to the Two River Theater in Red Bank to see Hunk. Why don't you tell us about that?
Hunk is such a nice show. It really is. And I'm very surprised it hasn't shown up on Broadway because it is written by Drew and Stiles, the people who added the new songs to Mary Poppins, one of which I think is sensational, called Practically Perfect. I adore that song. They also did a version of Peter Pan that hasn't shown up here. And you might think, we don't need a new musical of Peter Pan. But I'll tell you, theirs is terrific. Really wonderful. The Captain Hook songs especially are really marvelous. But Hunk won the Olivier Award as Best Musical the same year as Lion King was produced in London. So obviously there are people who like it. I'm very surprised that somebody hasn't taken a chance on it. What I was hoping was that this production of Two River would be so good that they would pick it up and bring it to the Lyceum. Well, today it was announced, of course, that Venus and Fur is going to the Lyceum because it's doing so well, and it has to get out of the Friedman because, of course, Wit is coming in. So as a result, the Lyceum isn't available. But frankly, I have to admit that this isn't the quintessential production of Hunk. I've seen two others. I've seen it at North Shore in Beverly, and I've seen it in Music Theater of Wichita in Kansas, and those productions were better. But it's a very nice version of The Ugly Duckling. But what it's really talking about is, more than anything else, about how people feel different, whether that be gay, whether that be ugly, whether that be eccentric. One size fits all here. The song that the young man sings, the young ugly duckling sings, Paolo Montalban plays the part, by the way, about being different, really does speak to everybody who's ever felt different, and which of us has not? I mean, really, there are very few people who don't feel different somewhere along the line. So it really speaks to all of us in that way. A very sweet show, a lot of puns that work very nicely. A lot of people groan at puns, but I have to say, in the three times I've visited Honk in these three different states, I've never heard anybody groan at one of the puns. They seem to appreciate them, and that shows they're of a very high order. But this production is just a tad too slow. And aside from Kenita R. Miller, who plays the Ugly Duckling's mother, who's very devoted to him, you know, even though he has a face and a body that only a mother would love, she really loves it, and she really will climb every mountain and ford every stream when he gets lost to find him. It has one of the great optimistic show songs of all time, and I mean that of all time, because there was a time when Broadway musicals were known for having optimistic songs. Put on a happy face, you gotta have heart, climb every mountain, happy talk, you gotta have a dream, if you don't have a dream, how are you gonna have a dream come true? Good times are here to stay. We got a million of them. We don't lately. But there's a wonderful one where he meets the ugly duckling meets a bullfrog. And the bullfrog assures him that someday someone's going to love you, warts and all. And it's funny, of course, coming from a frog, since, of course, frogs have been said to cause warts. So it's the perfect animal to be singing this song. It really is a wonderful 5-minute showstopper. And I have to say, while the audience appreciated it at the opening on Saturday night and certainly gave it the loudest applause of the night, both at Wichita and in Beverly, Massachusetts, they were applauding during the song, too. So I'm sorry that this is not the quintessential production of Hunk. However, since it doesn't seem to be coming anywhere near New York City, I would say that it does pass muster, and it is worth going down to Two River, which is a beautiful theater in New Jersey. I mean, really, a handsome, handsome house, only about 5 years old. And it's not hard to get to on New Jersey Transit. it. There is a Red Bank stop, and it's very close to the theater. It won't take you more than a minute and a half to walk from the train to the theater. But it's a first-class operation, even though this is not quite a bullseye. It's not far away from one. And for those who know this show from the London cast album or even the Wichita cast album, here's the chance to see it live. And at least it's a handsome-looking production. They spent money on it. So so there.
Well, that's a great little town, Red Bank.
Oh, it is, isn't it?
Yeah. A lot of history of theater there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and to wrap it up tonight, let's talk about Once, which before it officially opened off Broadway has decided to come to Broadway, but it seems to be a darling right now. What did you is it the darling that everybody else is making it out to be?
I didn't like it all that much. I think the music's marvelous. The music is so haunting and beautiful. Oh, I can't wait for a cast album. That part of it is really successful. I'm afraid the story struck me as rather trite. Boy who wants to be an artist, doesn't know how to do it, meets a girl who encourages him. I mean, it's that story. I also have to say that, and I'm not blaming Kristen Milioti for this, because she is doing the job of this character, but I found her character, not the actress, no, the character, insufferable. She's the type of girl who thinks she's adorable. And I may have mentioned this, but recently, I know I was talking to somebody, so this may be repeating myself, but when I met Robert Redford once, I said to him, why don't you come back to Broadway? And he gave me a quotation that actually shows up in William Goldman's The Season, that William Goldman interviewed Redford, and Redford said, you know, I mean, it's just that every script I get, I wind up at the end of the show with my hat in my hand saying to the girl, you're kooky and mad and wonderful and adorable and I love you. And that's what happens here in essence. I mean, and she's supposed to be kooky and adorable. I just found her a pain. And I think that's something I must confess that comes with age, because young men who meet girls like this do think they're wonderful because they haven't had the experience of actually day-to-day living with these people. And when they do, they realize how difficult it is. So a woman like this just telegraphs trouble to me. But I do think younger people will find her endearing and charming and beautifully eccentric. But she drove me crazy and I wanted no part of her. So I'm in the minority on Once. Most critics adored it. Most audience members I know are crazy about it. And I will certainly stand in line with them when it comes to the music. Which is glorious beyond belief. And so that, and the cast is wonderful. You can't fault the cast at all. But I did find the story trite. I have to say, I never heard of this movie, even though it produced an Oscar-winning song. And so I didn't know anything about it. But word had been filtering that this was the hit of the season. So I went to it with high hopes. Ironically enough, my girlfriend didn't want to go that. And she said, I'm tired. I'm not going to go. I said, Linda, this is the one. I mean, everybody says, this is the one. I think you should go. Yeah. All right. And she left at intermission. So she was pretty put off by the heroine as well. So you don't have to be an older man to be driven crazy by this young girl, apparently. So, you know, if people like it, good. You know, I don't have anything against it, really. If it strikes the chord with the Broadway audience, it's fine. But, you know, it doesn't have famous people in it. And while it doesn't look like it costs all that much to run, which still means a fortune by Broadway standards, because everything costs a lot of money, I don't think it's going to be an easy sell, frankly. I'm not sure of its commercial success. And certainly by getting less than a rave from Ben Brantley and the Times, even though the Times isn't the omnipotent power it once was, the fact remains that still a lot of people pay attention to that review. And it wasn't the rave that they expected it to be the morning after they had announced, hey, we're going to Broadway. So we shall see.
Yeah, it I've shown many, many times on this podcast how little I know about whether something's going to run or not. So I'm starting
to. It's impossible. It really is. I mean, you know, there are so many factors in why things happen. And, you know, I mean, making predictions is such difficult work. I even hate doing it when, you know, the time comes for the Tonys, because nobody knows anything, as Goldman says. You know, I mean, it's really true.
Absolutely.
You know, So
all we can do is leave it up till next week, where we'll have to leave it for right now. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio section. In that section, there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. That way, you won't miss anything. You can also listen to us on the Stitcher with the Stitcher application on your iPhone or smartphone device or Android or BlackBerry. You could listen to us through the Google Listen application and many other ways, various things out there. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And if you want to get in touch with Peter, myself, Michael, who I think Michael will be back next week. We just ran into a scheduling problem this week. And information about the various things we talked about each week, you go to BroadwayRadio.com, and there's show notes for all the information about things we've talked about, plus our contact information. There's phone numbers, email addresses, Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts, everything else that you might want to find us through. So on behalf of Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway. Good night.
Night.
Wax me with her toast as she puts me through the paces. I try not to yell, but it's hard when she prefers the mermaid over Belle. Nina doesn't care if the crowd is so impressed. She just makes a face and spits up on my dress. She's never seen my name up on the marquee. She's the princess now, I'm just plain old me. She's never seen me in the spotlight's glare. Nina doesn't care if my hair's just right or I took three curtain calls. She just needs me there to hold her tight. When she falls, Nina doesn't care if I've had a lousy night, tired voice worn out, every song a fight, or if I lost the part, a role I wish I'd won, or got a bad review. What more could I have done than holding her's the answer to my prayer? Doesn't